And I got a question for you guys today. How many people here today are not sick? Yeah, like a 50% of them. It's crazy. You know, I work with Alan all the time, and he's from a different generation. You know, he's like a rock, never complaining, but I'm a millennial, so when I get sick, I really get sick, you know, and it just drains me. And, you know, here this morning, we're going to be talking about, in the book of Matthew, what's known as the mini-apocalypse. So some tough times and some tough things. And the question is, how do we move through these things and how do we face them? So today we're looking at Matthew chapter 24, verses 1 to 14. Now, as per usual, I want to recommend, if you have a Bible, particularly in these passages, I highly recommend you pull that out, whether on an app or whatever. You can kind of glance and see where I'm about to go. It will be on the screen, but I kind of let it unfold. So if you want to look ahead, I totally recommend that. So that's Matthew chapter 24, verses 1 to 14. Now, I'm going to just kind of jump into it. But you have to remember what I'm always saying here. These things like this mini-apocalypse in Matthew, they don't just arise out of nowhere in the book, okay? This is one big movie. All these scenes are setting, and this arrives at a climactic part in the book. Okay, so let's begin our movie here today. You know, seeing a child be born has to be the most insane, holy, terrifying and awe-inspiring thing I have personally ever gone through. When my child was born, I wept. It was totally involuntary. It's just so dramatic. It's too much to process. It's like the absolute climax and collision of all of the pain and the purpose just happening all at once, growing, 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 and boom! Suddenly, fresh life explodes into the world. Yeah, like laboring life into existence is completely insane. There's all these crushing pressures, hunger, mood swings, body changes, and that's just you being the husband. I can only imagine what it actually feels like to be pregnant. You know, mothers go through a lot to bring life into the world. Have you ever thought about that? They have a really fierce love. The kind of love that fights through pain because they are laser focused on the purpose. Their love faces agony because it is faced in the ultimate hope, the hope of birth, the tangible and touchable victory of life despite the pain. Now, why do I speak of this here? Well, do you guys remember what Alan talked about last week? Does anybody know kind of, what's that? Last week he was talking about the woes, right? The judgment. These things, okay? So in the passage Alan preached on last week, interestingly though, at the very end of it, if you look at the scene, Jesus has just described himself as what? Does anyone remember this? Yeah, a judge and also a hen, okay? A mother hen. Longing to shelter Jerusalem under his wing with this fierce maternal love. But they were not willing. It is to me, if you think about it, the most agonizing section of all of Scripture. God himself, with all power, with all love, with all desire, with all hope, but unable to save his child from destruction. The leaders have chosen to face the coming storm of judgment without the shelter of his wing. Jesus says he faces and feels the terror like a mother who is helpless to shield her child from the agony of their own tragic choices. And his heart is completely undone. The Gospel of Luke actually tells us that Jesus cries with loud, uncontainable grief. He loves them with the fierce love of having birthed them, and he's willing to face any pain to bring them to life once again, yet they will not let him. And that brings me to the second reason I speak of birth here. Because this is what Jesus is about to teach his disciples how to understand. He's not describing the end of the world. He's teaching them how to endure the pain, he says, of a world being born. So as we read this today, keep your eyes laser focused on the purpose as Jesus speaks of the pain. So here we are, Matthew 24, verses 1 to 14. We're going to break this down slowly, see if we can unearth it. Verse 1, Jesus left the temple and was going away, when his disciples came to point out to him all the buildings of the temple. But he answered them, "You see all these, do you not? Truly I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." Alan and I have been talking about this for weeks, this massive lead up to this part of the movie. And we've explained that the rot and the corruption of this religious system was so deep, it permeated so much that Jesus says not even one single stone of it could remain. What looked beautiful and bountiful, this temple beyond human comprehension, a literal wonder of the world, was a curse and a blight in the eyes of Jesus. The fig tree meant to feed the world was barren and fruitless. It had become an actual barrier and impediment to the world blessing plan of God. So Jesus promised he would take it down, not to destroy life, but to remove what is in life's way. Verse 3, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" When will these things be? What things? What is the context here? What's Jesus talking about? Yes, there you go, okay? The destruction of the temple itself. Jesus is seated on the Mount of Olives, that's just opposite the temple, looking directly at it. And his disciples ask, "What will be the sign of your coming?" What an odd question. I mean, he's literally standing right beside them. Where did they figure he's gone? Okay. Don't you think that's a weird question? Like, Andrew, we're here right now. What's the sign of your coming? Like, where was I going? Okay? We have to understand the word that they use here. It's not that they've lost their minds. The word they use is a well-known term called parousia. That's the word for coming. It is the word for a city's king or emperor, its rightful owner coming to it in a royal visitation. Remember, you got to let this movie play out. It was unanimous that the Messiah was thought to be a warrior king. And the disciples themselves have blocked all of Jesus' efforts to reframe these expectations. And now, Jesus has just been rejected by the Jerusalem elites and declared the temple's destruction. So the disciples want to know, when is he going to finally show up in the fullness of all his kingly power, overthrow the false leaders of Jerusalem, and establish the Messianic age? That time when the Messiah becomes king, and everything will be set right, and they can take their seats of power alongside him. When would all of these things culminate in this glorious goal, this end game that they're longing for? It's extremely important that we realize that the end they were seeking was not the end of the space-time universe, but the end goal of their people's story. The time when Israel's Messiah would be enthroned at last as the true king of the whole world. This is what we call the end of the world, in the sense of an end that is an aim or goal. The Greek word that we're translating as end here is called telos. It is the word for goal, the end goal of Israel's wondrous world story. Now, imagine the disciples' utter dismay. Okay, you picture this with me. Imagine their utter dismay if the moment the Messiah finally became the king of the world, that the Creator God suddenly destroyed the very world for which he had become the Savior and the King. Do you think that would make sense? Okay. It would make nonsense of the entire story. You see, the Messiah becomes king to finally and climactically save and set the world right by his enthronement over it. That is what you call the goal. That is the telos of the story, the ultimate aim that all of these things are working towards. And the disciples want to know, how will all of this work out? Verse 4, Jesus begins to answer. And Jesus answered them, "See that no one leads you astray. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and they will lead many astray. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not alarmed, for this must take place. But the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and earthquakes in various places." Now, in order for the disciples to understand how the grand story will reach its telos, its aim and goal, Jesus is saying they have to keep the correct end, aim, in sight. Notice how he begins then. He says, "Take heed. Okay? Watch out. Don't be duped." Why? Because other people are going to claim to be king. Person after person claiming that they deserve to be followed and can move the world forward to its intended aim. And he says many people will get sucked in. Why? Because war does that kind of thing to people. When we are squeezed and threatened, we look for weapons and power to achieve our purpose, and we align ourselves with those who promise to offer it. Am I right? Okay, well, that never happens to me. Shame on you guys. No. Jesus is explaining to his disciples that this is the way the world is. But they are not to be either drawn in or even alarmed by it, he says. Why? Because they must remember this is not the end. It is not the telos. Jesus is saying, if you confuse the end, you will confuse the means to the end. War cannot and will not bring about the world God is birthing. Jesus says, if you think it does, you are a sitting duck who is going to get duped. Jesus warned his disciples of all this. He says, it's very simple. Nations will fight. He was pretty accurate. It will disrupt food stores. The world will shake. But you must not trust in those who claim to be king, no matter how powerful they appear. And equally, you must not read these as signs that the world is falling apart, in danger, and dying. Jesus says these are not signs of the death of his world. What does he call them? Anyone on the next verse? What's that? Birth pains. That's called contractions. Am I right? Okay. Jesus calls these things the beginning of birth pains. The word he uses is arche, the arche of birth pains. This is the language from where we get our English word archetype. Jesus is saying to his disciples, you need to learn to read this world's story as filled with signs not of impending death, but of contractions bringing life. Why? Why is this so important? Because otherwise you're going to get the whole story wrong. Because this world story is headed towards life. That's what Jesus has already said in the book of Matthew. Remember, Jesus had explained in Matthew 19. I obviously did a poor job of this. He had explained that his ultimate goal is a new Genesis. A new Eden, a new world, a fresh birth. Peter had wondered what would make following Jesus worth it when it was so much sacrifice to go his way. And Jesus said he was offering nothing short of a world reborn. He was encouraging the disciples that their sacrifice was not and would not be in vain, but would actually be part of birthing God's new world. If we do not get this end, this aim, and this goal in our minds, Jesus is saying we will not be able to face the task of laboring the new world into existence, because we will be like a pregnant woman who doesn't know she is in labor. Being pregnant with life and not knowing it would be crazy terrible. It's like facing a holy task without any of the hope, anticipation, and desire that are necessary to fuel the journey of bringing life forth. You will not be able to push through the pain unless you can clearly see the purpose. Ladies, if someone asked you to go through labor just for the heck of it, how many would sign up? Zero people. Okay? Now imagine being these guys who have never been pregnant before, right? In a world ravaged by death. Imagine being pregnant with life, but having no idea what pregnancy even was. you would think you were dying. Okay? You would totally misread all the signs of what was happening to you. Instead of signs of the contractions of impending life, you would read signs of impending doom. And that would make it extremely difficult to birth life. Because the thing that is paradoxical about giving birth is it's something that both happens to you, but it also must happen through you. In order to push through the pain, you need to intimately and thoroughly understand the purpose so you can properly recognize the signs and breathe instead of panic and push when you're supposed to push instead of pause, right? Yeah. Is there a doctor in the house? Is this true? Anybody? Has anybody else been through pregnancy other than me? Am I right in saying this? Okay. And now here's the crazy thing. The thing about birthing life, tell me if this is true, is that the closer one gets to making it happen, the more intensity and pain they endure. True? Okay. I was a witness to this as I watched my wife go through it. And I stood in awe as I saw beyond a shadow of a doubt that pain and agony can be pushed through with determination when it has a clear purpose and is faced in hope and in absolute anticipation of life. Right? And what is forged in that crucible of laboring life into existence is, in my humble opinion, the absolute fiercest of all loves. The love of a mother for her child. You know that, have you ever heard these stories? These are like documented miracles where a vehicle gets like stuck on a child and a mom will lift off the vehicle. Have you heard of this? These are documented, okay? And they will shear their spine or whatever and do these Herculean things. That's some kind of love, man. Right? I try and weightlift. I can't lift any cars. Love can. Okay? The love of a mother for her child. A self-sacrificing, pain-taking, laboring love that makes life itself possible. This is radical stuff. Verse 9. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and put you to death, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will fall away and betray one another and hate one another, and many false prophets will arise and lead many astray. Now, these verses, like all the other verses, do not appear out of thin air. Notice, right after explaining that we must learn to see the world as facing pain, to labor life into existence, Jesus talks about tribulation. This word tribulation means crushing pressure. As those who assert claim to be the king of the world press against those who follow Jesus as the true king of the world, Jesus says there will be immense pressure to defect. Pressure that makes you want to quit the labor and give up the hope that there can ever or will ever be a new world's birth. False prophets saying, there's no life coming. So there is no purpose to push through the pain. You know, it is so much easier to join the violence or simply give up than it is to enter into the vocation of painfully laboring for God's new world. And Jesus warns us that many people will not be able to bear it. And the cries of false prophets to take up swords and power and fight back will become music to the ears of those who have lost their heart because they've lost sight of the end, the aim, and the goal. Verse 12. And because of this, lawlessness will be increased. The love of many will grow cold. Again, we have to stay in context. Jesus is simply not talking about the world getting worse and worse and bad people inevitably becoming more bad. Why? Because that doesn't sound like birth pains. That sounds like hopelessness and helplessness that breeds apathy. What Jesus is saying is that as people who sought to follow him face the pressures of birthing life into a world filled with violence and death, that temptation to give in and give up is really hard to escape. And the result is an increase in lawlessness. And of course, Jesus here is referring to something, it seems to me, happening amongst God's own people. He's not talking about those pagans out there somewhere. Okay? The context is his disciples and what they will go through. Jesus describes those who abandon his kingship and goal as falling into lawlessness. But what does this mean? Well, remember, We've said this multiple times in the book of Matthew, but it's such a massive book, it's hard to keep all these things in our minds. Remember, the word law is not the same as the word commandments. They are two different words. Law does not simply mean rules. Okay? It is actually the word Torah. Okay? And the Torah is far more than rules. It is a grand story, or the grand story, of the first five books of the Bible, which come to us mostly as narrative. A world story of a people that were sent not simply to perfectly follow rules, but to actually be the answer to the world's problems. And that answer began with Abraham and the story of his children sent to bless all the nations of the earth. That is Torah's great story. And the commandments fall into that narrative as a means of being a blessing. Not rules to keep people from the world, but to keep them fruitful for the world's sake. To keep them blessers in a world reeling from curse, so that the world will always have people filled with life, determined to drive back darkness and death. But Jesus is saying that the temptation is always that those who bear this hope for the world will grow weary and give up on hope, and that they will turn inward. And instead of blessing, will seek merely to be blessed. And they will lose sight of their task and forget their story. And instead of facing the pain of laboring for life in love, they will build up walls. This is another way to translate what Jesus is saying. Not lawlessness as in simply without rules, but Torah-lessness. People who have forgotten their own world story and purpose. Jesus is saying that his people will be tempted to defect from his kingship, turn from the goal of laboring in love to birth a fresh earth, and instead become Torahless, nationalistic sitting ducks, ripe for false prophets and false messiahs who offer a convenient, self-serving, comfortable, and painless path. And they're really good at selling it. And when the laboring of life story dies, Jesus says, so does that love that keeps it alive. The agape of many grow cold, he says. Agape love is that self-sacrificing, pain-taking love that purposefully faces pain to push life into the present. It's maternal laboring, life-making kind of love. It is fierce and determined and is the very thing that enables any life to exist at all. Verse 13. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. You notice how this word end repeatedly comes up? Now, we were all born because someone loved us into life. Amen? Amen. This is the story of every single one of us. Someone pushed through the pain and bore us in the crucible of their fiercely determined love. There is no human who has ever been born any other way, including Jesus, right? We are all here because someone had the courage to enter the delivery room. And no matter how difficult, and no matter how great the pain, they stayed. And through all the hurt and the harm, they endured until the end, the aim. There is no other way to reach the goal of life. Now, I don't know if you have looked at social media lately. According to them, our world is hopeless. It has lost hope. Our young people have lost heart. We hear of wars and rumors of wars. We have every reason to doubt that this world is pregnant with any life at all. Am I right? Religion after religion offers escape. Earlier this year, I had a chance to go to an interfaith dialogue, I think they're calling it now, because people don't argue anymore. Okay? Every single religion on offer offers soul escape. Every single one. Release from needing to engage with the pain and a way out. I believe with all of my heart that this is not the Christian gospel or call. The Creator God is not looking for those who can grit their teeth and bear it and hang on while the entire world burns. He is looking for those who can grit their teeth and birth it. Pushing through the pain because their heart burns with agape, birth-making, earth-shaping, fiercely enduring, laboring life into existence through determined love. Jesus says the one who stays in the labor, the one who does not quit the birth, that one will see the day when life bursts forth. Finally, verse 14. And this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. Let's wrap all this together. The temple elites were looking to build a wall around their power and protect it to make their people's story a self-serving, nationalistic story. Jesus, as the true King and Messiah, would break open the tomb to release new life and birth a new world. The disciples need to therefore know the telos, the ultimate aim, that it was not the survival of a religious system, but the actual genesis of a new creation. Jesus became king because only the Creator could birth life into his dying world. If he does not defeat death and ascend, what we call the ascension, to the throne, all the labor will be in vain. The contractions would inevitably lead simply to the world's end. But his resurrection and enthronement become the guarantee that the pain of the world are not signs of its impending death, but its impending birth into new life. This is the telos, the goal and aim of Jesus becoming king. He does not take the throne to rule over the old dying ruins, and certainly not for a great escape. He takes the throne to accomplish the birth he has always intended for his earth. The disciples' job, therefore, and our job, is to keep this gospel alive by refusing to lose the hope of our story and by refusing to let our pain-taking, earth-making love grow cold. We take this message to our friends and neighbors and nations, not to win an apologetics argument, but to offer an invitation. Stop fighting for a dying world and start laboring for the new one being born. This is the end. Not destruction, not collapse, birth. A world where Jesus is king, a world being made new, a world brought forth through a people who refuse to give up on agape love. So here is the question that Jesus leaves with you as his disciples. The question is not whether the world is in pain. The question is whether you believe it is dying or finally dying.